Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 5069, the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We have a full agenda today. We're going to start off with some budget detail from Director Warner, and then we're going to move into a follow-up on our meeting from yesterday with the Motor Carrier Transportation Program with Greg Del Ponte. Welcome, Director.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I don't believe I had any response to questions from yesterday's testimony, and I think we answered most all of them to the committee's satisfaction. If not, you need to let us know. I believe where we left it was on page 6 of the Motor Carrier Program, and where they were almost done with their programmatic review. Mr. Del Ponte can crank up from that point if you'd like. Or I might suggest, because I know you're a bit behind in your timeline, since we have gone over the performance measures, which is what he would cover next, since we covered those in phase one, maybe the best would be to go from there right into page 12, which gets into the history of his budget and his budget detail and his performance options. But that's just a way to help speed things up if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other argument, why don't we do that?
Glad I could be here to help you out, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Come on in.
Sorry for keeping you
waiting,
Mr. Director.
We're busy. We're all busy. So, welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and get us underway.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Greg Del Ponte. I'm the administrator of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. I sped through yesterday a description of our program service offerings, and at this point in the presentation, I'm on page 12. And I'm just going to highlight just a couple of the major changes that have occurred in the past 10 years. And then I'll conclude with the discussion of budget and program option packages. Going back 10 years, in 1995, via a budget note appended to Senate Bill 1149, the department was directed to create a advisory committee, the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. We did so, and that continues to operate today, and it's one of the longest-running advisory groups of its kind between ODOT and the motor carrier industry. And it's proven to be an extremely beneficial and useful forum for problem-solving and education and working towards voluntary compliance. In 2001, the composition of the Motor Carrier Division changed when the Motor Carrier Audit Section was moved over from ODOT Central Services Division to the Motor Carrier Division, adding 57 FTE and $7 million to the budget. I discussed yesterday, but I'll just highlight again today, the two significant differences, changes that have occurred in our operating environment over the last 10 years has been the successful deployment and utilization of our Greenlight Way Station Preclearance System, which I discussed in depth yesterday.
Okay.
But since its inception, we have pre-cleared more than 5 million trucks that didn't need to stop at an Oregon way station using that intelligent transportation technology. In addition, I discussed yesterday in detail our trucking online internet-based service offering. It's a key component of our service delivery. Motor carriers are able to complete and have completed since its inception almost 250,000 transactions that used to require a phone call, fax, or a mail delivery. We're now doing online. I think a significant thing I'd like to draw to the attention of the committee is that on January 1, 1996, when the Motor Carrier Transportation Division was created, we had 345 FTE. And I've already mentioned that in 2001, we added 57 FTE when the audit section was merged with our division. Since that time, we've reduced our original workforce by 24%. We've continued to perform every one of the existing work functions that we originally performed in 1996. We've accepted and incorporated every workload increase that's come along the path in the intervening 10 years. And I think of interest is that we have actually reduced 81 positions during that time, and that's a 21% reduction in FTE. And in accomplishing that reduction in FTE over the years, we have maintained an excellent customer service assessment, and we measure that through regularly performed customer service surveys. And we've also we have improved our performance in terms of the outcome-based performance measurements that we maintain.
With respect to your employees as opposed to the public that you're serving, it always begs the question, does that mean that you were too fat back then, or your folks are overburdened now? Or have you found the comfortable point? I'm not sure how to take the information.
Mr. Chairman, good question, fair question. And I think the answer is that we have been very methodic about incorporating technology and the incorporation of technology as it became available and as it was perfected. And the two notable examples are Greenlight and Trucking Online. We've been able to do things faster, more efficiently than we used to do in a manual version. That's one answer. We've also changed some of our business practices. In prior legislative sessions, we were sensitive to some of the discussions that took place regarding what was perceived to be administrative inefficiencies around weight mile tax administration. And in partnership with the Legislative Assembly, we've made some program changes which have enabled us to be quicker and more efficient and have enabled us to eliminate some of our staffing. So I don't think it was ever the case that we were overstaffed, but we have been strategically releasing staff when we found that it was reasonable to do so, to still perform the job, still accomplish the mission, and to not reduce customer service delivery.
I got it. Thanks. Senator Berger.
Yes. How many of your staff that left your department actually left state government? Did they go into other departments within ODOT?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, another good question. I could give you a detailed distribution and will if you'd like, but in general, I would say to you that the overwhelming majority of these folks are no longer employed by the division. We did not discharge people. We were able to do this by, when positions became vacant, we judiciously held them vacant, while we took the opportunity of the vacant position to consider whether or not it was necessary to fill it. In other cases, we would close an office and we would redistribute staff from the closed office to vacancies in the Salem Central office and then not fill the vacancies and abolish them. So in large measure, they are true abolishments. To a smaller extent, some of them have been redeployed to other parts of ODOT.
So are you telling me that most all of them either remained in your division in a different position or remained in the Oregon Department of Transportation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, no, ma'am.
No.
They are, in fact, true position savings in the majority of instances. They are no longer employed, and they represent true position eliminations and real dollar savings. On page 16, I'll just point out there was a request that we discuss our use of professional services and contracts. Motor Carrier Transportation Division makes very limited use of purchasing contracts. Your document lists the few that we have. We operate a medical waivers program that has a small interagency contract employing a physician from the Department of Human Services. We have a sole source contract for the provision of maintenance dollars for our proprietary green light systems. There's a $7,000 contract for a university at Albany, New York professor to do the statutorily required flat fee study every even-numbered year. And then we have a contingency contract for expert witness for our tax audit hearings. And another dollar amount of $70,000. We have very minimal contracting. The department had no legislative concepts filed pre-session. On page 17, you see our budget detail. The variance from 2003-2005 to 2005-2007 is just over a $3 million increase. And if you take a look at the bottom of page 17, expenditures by category, you'll see that that $3 million is almost wholly represented in personal services increase, a wage and benefit increase.
Are we missing opportunities? to garner federal dollars within the Motor Carrier Transportation Division if we were stepping up and doing other activities? Or are we getting the greatest leverage possible at this point?
Mr. Chairman, the division does have the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program grant, and then we are aware of opportunities for other federal grants when they become available, but we're judicious about seeking approval to apply for them. And by that I mean, if the dollars are to be expended on activities which we do not believe advance our program mission or purpose, or if they require, for instance, hiring employees when there's no certainty of continuing federal fund provision, we are reluctant to even bring that forward to the legislature for consideration.
Let me flip that
okay.
Really quick, and I don't know the answer to this question, but are there opportunities for the counties or cities to participate in programs where the state could just forward information onto them? Or do they have a level of sophistication to where they know what's available to them as well? And the reason I ask that question is, you know, the state's one partner, but the counties and the cities are also partners. And, you know, while I assume some of the larger counties were able to know how to take care of themselves, I think some of the smaller counties aren't even aware of opportunities that may be available.
Mr. Chairman, I think you've given the answer I would give, that I'm reluctant to speak about the acumen of the counties and local governments, but I will tell you that when we become aware of a grant opportunity that might appropriately be made available to a county, we do share that through our MCSAP contacts with the counties with whom we have working relationships.
I assume that's all of them.
To a greater or lesser extent.
Okay. But there is a system in place within the Motor Carrier Transportation Division to forward leads on to folks, even though they may not be a good fit for us, they may be a fit for someone else.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to leave you with the impression that there's a formalized methodology that, to do so, but I believe it's the case, and I know that I myself, on occasion, have seen an opportunity and picked up the phone and called a colleague at a county level that I thought could perform or reasonably provide service.
Just in the back of your mind, if in the future you see those opportunities to forward those on and maybe a better fit for someone else than for the state.
Yes.
Do that. Thank you.
On page 18, the essential packages are probably self-explanatory, with the possible exception of the phase-in green light maintenance $800,000 item. And in essence, all that's transpiring here, instead of charging to a highway division account, we're putting the budget in the division where the work is actually managed, and we're moving dollars from highway to Motor Carrier Transportation Division, and the approximate dollar amount to cover the contract for maintenance for the proprietary green light system that I spoke to a moment ago. In terms of policy option packages, package 301, information resource management. In essence, we're seeking here to restore dollars that were cut during the last legislative session. I've highlighted trucking online in this presentation. I spoke about that. I spoke about Greenlight, and I spoke about the significant cost avoidance opportunities that technology allows us to take advantage of. We are facing a reduction of a significant numbers of hours of IS staff support through IT contractors. The result of that is that we're now dependent upon ODOT staff. Normally occurring requests for work to handle system changes that are required on a routine basis, on a monthly basis, are taking longer to handle. System failures are taking longer to resolve, due in part to the loss of IT contractors because of a reduction of these IRM dollars. The IT contractors, by and large, had developed particularly specialized skill sets and expertise to augment the ODOT IS staff. IS staff is absorbing the workload of the departing IT contractors. In essence, I don't have any dollars. I don't have the wherewithal to fund some of this low-hanging IT work. And some of the things that we would ordinarily be able to do at a more accelerated pace might be things we've successfully accomplished. We've automated the submission of citations to certain traffic courts. We do that electronically. We have enabled the insurance industry to electronically submit insurance filings and just have them simply register in our database without having to go through staff. This staff and these IRM dollars have been used to create an automated vertical height database for our overdimension permitting staff, as opposed to a paper system that requires a lot of hands-on management and a lot of custody control. There are other examples, but these dollars would restore our ability to stay on the cutting edge and to maintain service delivery in the manner in which our customers have grown accustomed. Package 90 is the DAS Smarts buy reduction.
Let me interrupt there really quick and ask Susie if she could explain to the committee how the Smart Buy Reduction Program works. Once again, I know it's a statewide initiative.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer that to Christina Shearer since it's the governor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shearer with Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. The Smart Buy Program is a series of group contracts that are being administered to maximize the potential savings and the buying power of the state. It's been targeted in several areas, and these are the estimated costs that we expect to recoup for the coming biennium. This program is ongoing, and we anticipate there will be additional costs or cost savings in the future, but at this point, this is our best estimate of the kinds of savings we can expect by utilizing these contracts.
So are those savings based upon then the 0507 number or the 0305 number?
Mr. Chair, they were calculated using proportions from the 0305 actual expenditure levels, but were projected at the 0507 anticipated spending levels. So in other words, the proportions allocated by agency were based on the activity of the 0305 biennium, but were projected forward to 0507 spending rates.
The reason I raise that issue is I applaud the governor in Smart Buy Reduction Program. It makes sense. I just want to make sure, though, that Oregonians understand that doesn't necessitate a reduction in categories such as services and supplies, but rather just a tool to help rein in some of those expenses.
It's an attempt to get better prices, yes.
Yeah, because when you look at the Motor Carrier Transportation Division under services and supplies, we're still increasing that by $550,000, even though we're through smarter purchasing, we're saving $284,000.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I inadvertently skipped over package 495. That is just a fee ratification package. Last legislative session, Senate Bill 471 was passed, directing the department to create a registration system for pack and loaders, an alternative to household good movers, and it required establishment of fee, and this is the fee ratification required by Senate Bill 333. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a note on that fee. Tomorrow you'll hear the fee bill, and that's one of the fees that will be included in that fee bill.
Okay. And that's in a public hearing?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to ask Martin Loring to come up for the public transit program. And while he's coming up, really quick, colleagues, we have some special guests here today from the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee. And I understand three of the members are here. We've got Chair Koberstein, Vice Chair Owens, and also Mike Laverty. You gentlemen could, and lady, could just stand up. Thank you very much for coming today. I don't know if any of you would like to say a few words. Would you like to come up and say a few words? Yeah, come on up.
No,
we appreciate you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Koberstein. I'm the chair of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, and thank you for just a moment of your time. I wanted to say how much I appreciate ODOT Director Bruce Warner and his involvement and support with transportation safety issues within ODOT and throughout the state, as well as the Transportation Safety Committee, the Transportation Commission. They've always been very good supporters and have really given us a lot of trust to do what we do. Troy Castellas has been our leader since 1997 as manager of the Transportation Safety Division, and one of the letters that we forwarded to you is from Mr. Curtis Winston, who's the regional administrator for NHTSA, commending Troy and the Transportation Safety Division on not only doing good work, but also being a model for other states throughout the United States and how to come up with citizen-driven programs for traffic safety, rather than telling the public what they need to do, actually getting the public to tell us what it is they'd like to see done. And he's been very instrumental in making sure that we could do that. It's very nice to be able to have an opportunity to work with people in government that do this kind of stuff. Some of our programs
with the certain school speed zone law last session.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what we can do with the school zones this time and not have to revisit it in 2 years. That would be nice, wouldn't it? But thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you.
Well, Mr. Chair, we appreciate you volunteering in this capacity, and we appreciate all the work you do for the state of Oregon. And you are correct. Director Warner does a fine job. And so thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, Mr. Warner. Come on back up.
No problem. Good afternoon, Chair Smith, committee members, and staff. My name is Martin Loring, and I work for ODOT as administrator of its Public Transit Division. Direct your attention to page one of the presentation. It includes an organization chart. Public Transit is the smallest of ODOT's divisions, with 14 and a half full-time equivalent positions requested and a budget requested of about $53 million in limitation, which would make us fourth largest of the divisions in terms of resources. The division's mission, vision, and values are touched upon in page two of the presentation. Priorities start on page two and continue on the third page. As you recall, ODOT's mission is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system moving people and goods efficiently to support economic development and livable communities. The Public Transit Division financially supports the movement of people to ensure that they can participate in the economy and enjoy a high quality of life. The division doesn't own transportation assets, nor do we operate them. We work through some 200 local entities around the state by providing grants and aid. Our customers are transit agencies, transit districts, mass transit districts, counties, other kinds of special purpose districts, cities, Indian tribal governments, and occasionally private for-profit businesses. Grant funds are used by these agencies to acquire vehicles or in some cases to operate them to meet these transportation needs. On page four, there's a table that organizes the division's budget into five program areas. These key program areas are special needs transportation services, general public transportation, transportation demand management, intercity passenger services, and statewide transportation demand. Page six starts a little more detailed discussion of each of those program areas. Special needs transportation serves seniors and people with disabilities. This is the division's number one priority. Our goal is to help meet the changing demographics of Oregon in terms of people's ability to move about, and more of that will be discussed as one of the major budget drivers.
Mr. Chair,
excuse me,
did you skip over rural passenger program between cities on page five?
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, it is in that table. I would cover it in a little more detail
later on
in three programs.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I just didn't want you to get by with leaving it out.
I shall not. Thank you. The next program is general public transportation. This is public transportation for anybody who wants to ride, including seniors and people with disabilities, but it's targeted broadly. Our goal is to provide coordinated, accessible service for people who want to ride. We manage two programs in this area, and both involve federal funds. There's a formula program that provides federal support for cities of fewer than 50,000 people in rural areas who want to operate transportation services. We administer that program. The other program we administer was approved by the 2003 legislature to help mass transit agencies replace old high-mileage vehicles. And with the $2 million you provided last session, we were able to help six agencies replace 14 vehicles. The next program is Transportation Demand Management. This encourages a variety of alternatives to driving alone in one's own car during peak transportation periods. We help people who want to use alternatives for some of their trips to reduce congestion, reduce air pollution, or use less energy. To quote Washington County Commissioner Tom Bryan, who's quite active in pushing us in this area, we try to help people, or to change behavior, we have to help people tune into radio station WIFM, which simply means what's in it for me. And we try to do this, and we are trying to do this with the funding provided by the 2003 legislature for the mass marketing of transportation alternatives. On page 8, we finally come to the intercity passenger program.
Well, let's go back really quick. Give us some examples on how we provide incentives to eliminate unnecessary trips.
Chair Smith, the legislature in 2003 provided $1.5 million to market alternatives. And we are working with Metro. We've just selected a contractor to do the mass marketing, to design and implement the mass marketing program in the three-county metropolitan area. We've gotten proposals from two consultants to do some direct marketing programs in three other areas of the state, and we'll be selecting between those two consultants in the next couple of weeks. And we're implementing a pilot direct marketing program in the interstate neighborhood of Portland using something called Dialogue Marketing, and a consultant hired by the city of Portland. The kinds of things we do are provide rideshare alternatives, information. Someone wants to commute over a distance, say from Salem to Portland, and they don't want to drive their car. Well, the city of Portland, city of Salem, TriMet, other agencies essentially maintain lists of people who would like to find someone else to ride with, either in a carpool or a van pool. We provide materials to help encourage telecommuting. Maybe one day a week, instead of driving to the office, you use your computer.
People find out about that list.
We have information on that.
I'm Joe Q, citizen. I'm in Portland. I want to go work in Salem.
This marketing will help address that.
Oh, it will help it.
Yes, provide that information. It's all about getting the information to people that they need to make their lives better.
Okay, so I'm going to underline the word will. We haven't started it yet. We're going to do it. I think that's terrific. I've actually had several folks who, when we were starting up in the legislature, who worked up in Portland, but couldn't justify coming down here knowing that they had to pay the fuel cost on it and therefore gave up working here.
The data that we have suggests that there are, oddly enough, about 3,600 people who live in the Portland area and work in the Salem area, and about the same number who live in the Salem area and work in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't seem to find a way to make them switch houses. but the freeway, I mean, the impact to ODOT's infrastructure every day is significant. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of them may want to drive their own car, and that's fine. But for those who prefer to spend less by riding with someone else, we try to help locate those people and make the connection.
Will it be done on a database where you can get online?
Chair Smith, yes. The city of Portland has developed a database that we're trying to make use of. The rideshare program in the city of Salem has their own database, and we're working hard trying to integrate and coordinate among those databases.
Okay, I'm from Eastern Oregon. I've got to ask the question. How do I know I'm not getting in a car with some kook? And how do you screen?
Chair Smith, the short answer is there is no mechanism to screen at the current time.
Buyer beware.
Buyer beware.
Okay, thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Could you address just briefly the HOV change of policy that has occurred in Washington?
Chair Smith, Senator Morris, no. I'm sorry to say. I don't know, but maybe Bruce can.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think we can get back to you some additional information on that, but I think you're referring to the additional lanes that were built on I-5 on the Washington side, mm-hmm. where essentially the additional lanes they built were dedicated as HOV lanes. And they essentially, when they constructed those, had decided that they would initially construct them as an HOV facility, monitor the usage, and then determine if they wanted those to continue to be HOV lanes. It's my understanding they're coming to the time where they have to make a decision whether to keep those as high occupancy vehicle lanes or to again change them back to general purpose lanes. I think they're finding out that without a terminus that runs through and across the Columbia River into Washington, there's clearly some issues of the benefit of that and people having to merge back. So I think they're questioning the value of limiting those to high occupancy vehicles. And the problem is, frankly, we don't have a system that's consistent on the Washington side and the Oregon side, which we're fast trying to figure out what to do so that you could have, for example, an HOV lane that would make sense and get you from one part of the region, i.e. in Washington, to another part of the region on the Oregon side. And absent that, I think they're going to be making some decisions. And what I'm hearing is they may very well be looking at eliminating those restrictions and opening them up to all general traffic, if I'm being responsive. Yeah. If not, I can get you some more information and detail on it.
I don't need more information.
Okay.
The narrative is adequate, but I've been curious why Oregon hasn't gone to an HOV lane. Is it just lane capacity?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, actually, if you look in the Portland metro region, there is an HOV lane on I-5 going northbound and southbound right now. Mm-hmm. It's limited to the times of day, and it's limited for its length. And as I said, that's part of the problem because you have to merge in at one end down by the Coliseum and merge back in up there near Delta Park, and it doesn't extend across the Columbia River because of the lack of lane capacity to link up with those lanes on the other side. And if it was a system and you had adequate through lanes, I think you might find that system would work much better than it does today. And that's one of the reasons the state of Washington has been pushing us very hard to look at expanding some of the capacity of I-5 south of the Columbia River. And we are doing some minimal improvements there, but we know we've got a bigger, longer-term issue in terms of the bridges and what we need for additional lanes to handle traffic now and over the next 20 to 50 years.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Carter.
Bruce, has Vancouver gotten to a point, or the state of Washington got to a point where they're willing to help deal with the management of the cars that in the HOV lanes that goes all the way from Portland into Vancouver?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we have been working very hard for the past 2.5 to 3 years to arrive at consensus with the state of Washington, the Vancouver region, as well as the Portland metropolitan region on a future of I-5.
Mm-hmm.
Through the Trade and Transportation Partnership, which was funded by the federal government and administered by the two departments of transportation, I believe the really good news is we have consensus now that we need to do some things in the I-5 corridor to deal with growth. Include expansion of the freeway, limited expansion, so that there's three through lanes in both directions and three through lanes over the Columbia River. But we also need transit. We look at either high-capacity buses, express buses, and or light rail, and we know we need to do some rail improvements in that corridor. So we have the plan. We have agreement on what we need to do. And right now, with the help of our congressional delegation and delegates on the Washington side, we have funding, and we're starting the actual initiation of the design work to figure out what can be done in those areas. As you know, there's a number of environmental and other neighborhood issues that we have to address in those areas. But I think you should feel good that we actually have agreement on the solutions, that we're starting to move forward on the limited improvements that we can until we get to the bigger improvement, which is, quite frankly, very large and well beyond the financial capabilities we have right at the present time.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Mr. Chairman, yesterday I had to go to Portland with the Senate President, and we were trying to get back to Salem, and at 3:40 yesterday, I had to go on 5 different arterial streets
mm-hmm.
before the Lloyd Center in order to get back on I-5 coming south. And to me, that is unconscionable, you know, in these days and times to have that kind of mix up. But until we can get Washingtonians
because all the traffic that's coming from Washington into Oregon, until we can get Washingtonians to agree on some kind of freeway. See, I would, number one, I would have put a toll up there so fast it would make your head swim. I really would. I mean, I really had thought about trying to do it through the legislature, but I was so discouraged by nobody wanting to vote for it. It was unbelievable. But until we get people to see the necessity through their pocketbooks that we can do things more efficiently, we're not going to get it done. And it's just unbelievable. I mean, the kind of freeway, what do you call it? I'm trying to think of the word, soot, whatever, that comes over from the gas and all that kind of stuff. It's just terrible. We have higher incidences from starting from 15 years ago today of kids being having asthma that OHSU was given a contract to work on these issues, because it's unbelievable what happened right in that corridor. We just have not been able to get anything done, and these guys don't want to do anything because we need Vancouver to cooperate. We need to say to Washington to cooperate, but it's...
Let me take off on that issue really quick, if we could just take a few more minutes on this. Mm-hmm. There is, the state of Oregon has been working on a solution, I assume.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And yes. Could you just take 3 minutes, because I'd be very interested in hearing what the alternatives are to that issue, because obviously anyone who's driven there knows we've got an issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to, again, give you the basic components of the consensus that we have. First off, again, we need to widen and add additional lanes to I-5 to, again, deal with the vehicular traffic, trucks, and automobiles. Three through lanes all the way through. And if you look at the bridges as an example, there's three lanes on the bridges, but because of the on- and off-ramps, essentially they only function as two.
Where does the role of the state of Washington play?
The state of Washington, and we will really be talking about the bridge crossing itself. Right. You're right.
So we don't have two bottlenecks.
Exactly.
The bridge.
And that has been the biggest problem in the I-5, and it is a bottleneck right now, as Senator Carter points out, for commerce, not only for the Portland metro region, but for the entire West Coast, and maybe even for the nation when you look at the traffic that's on I-5. So widening the freeway is clearly a component of it. We also know that if we, in order to help preserve that capacity for freight and for movement of goods and services, we need to encourage other folks, as Mr. Loring's talking about, to encourage them to get out of their cars and maybe use mass transit, or again to double up to use the carpool in those lanes.
Could light rail be expanded? I'm trying to figure out where it ends there.
The White Rail currently ends at the Expo Center.
At the Expo Center.
Just on the other side of the river. So the intent always would be that could be extended into Washington. As you know, that's been a sensitive issue for the folks in Vancouver. But I believe for the first time people, again, are starting to realize and say we need to have mass transit be part of the solution. So what I'm suggesting is highway and transit need to be a major component of the work. We're also looking at the heavy rail because, again, if we can, again, encourage a robust system that would allow more freight to get across a single-lane bridge for trains downstream of the I-5 corridor and eliminate some of the bottlenecks in that area in the Rivergate area, you can get a lot more freight onto that system.
So is Vancouver sensitive to this because they're watching human resources come across the river to Portland?
The issue of jobs and where jobs are being created always gets into this discussion. I think, again, as Senator Carter has pointed out, for the first time, we actually have agreements with the folks on the other side of the Columbia River that we ought to work together to manage how the areas develop and grow so that we're not encouraging people to drive more than they have to. But clearly there's a lot of folks living in the Vancouver area and the state of Washington that work in the Portland area. And again, we need to figure out a way to get them out of their cars if possible. And the same way for the folks from our side going across the river so that capacity is freed up. So the states of Washington and Oregon, through the Departments of Transportation, have initiated an environmental impact statement work that is essentially looking at the options and how you would actually make that river crossing, which is one of the biggest problems and issues you need to address so that, again, whatever you have on either side can match up to that. And so that will be the major emphasis. Also part of that discussion will be how we're going to finance this. And I think Senator Carter is right. I believe that when you look at the magnitude, sheer magnitude of that project, tolls and other things will probably be part of the solution for solving the transportation infrastructure.
What's the dollar cost ballpark?
Mr. Chair, I hate to speculate, but the numbers end with B, or the numbers begin, the beyond numbers start with B. So they're in the billions, and it depends on how much you want to take on in terms of highway and transit or pieces. I mean, they're very expensive, but also what you're hearing here is the problems are large, and they're going to impact the state of Oregon, Washington, and the West Coast unless we figure out a way to solve them.
Let's move on. Project's not going to get any cheaper.
Chair Smith, we left off on page 8, which discusses the intercity passenger program.
I'm going to push you along here. We've kind of gobbled up a bunch of your time. I apologize. I'm going to, you can just kind of...
This serves the needs of rural residents who need to connect to services in a larger community or to connect with transportation throughout the state or interstate transportation. In this, 15% of a certain type of federal funding we receive must be used to support these kinds of services, and that's what we do.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a couple of questions here? I'd like to get to the heart of why rural Oregonians are struggling so much to get this kind of service. And in my district, all over, I'd like to put a human face on it. Let me start off first by asking you, have you ridden the transit in the rural districts yourself?
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, not all of the transit providers. I've ridden some of them.
But you've ridden some rural transit, have you?
Yes.
Okay. For instance, in my district, I just got a note informing me that the transit from Brookings to Coos Bay was going to be eliminated. Now, if you eliminate anything coming in to Coos Bay, you are now eliminating all the seniors that do not drive, and you do not want them to drive, who are coming to the doctor and to the Bay Area Hospital off the services or to the radiation center. I want to put a human face on this, and I want you to tell me, what is it about these nonprofits that make them struggle? So is it the insurance cost? Is it the lack of know-how of filling out grant applications? What can we do about this? This is crucial with our population growing older and older in rural areas.
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, unfortunately the answer is yes to all those suggested clauses and more beyond. I just came from a meeting with Bill Dooley, who runs the agency that you referenced in Curry County, and he budgeted for fuel at $1.30 a gallon. He's paying $2.60.
That's right.
The best thing that we can do, and they have trouble. Bill is a dear man and a good manager, but he's a 74-year-old retiree who's doing the best he can to manage that agency. But he needs help. He works for a not-for-profit that has no resources of its own, no tax base, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They live off grant funds. And we do the best we can to try to support not only him, but the 100 and some other agencies in the state just like that, that are trying to do the best they can to meet the transportation needs of their seniors. What we're going to try to do, we have a grant allocation committee meeting later this week, and what we're proposing is that we get him some consulting help. There are good consultants around that can help put together a design for a system that will maximize on the amount of transportation that can be provided with the resources that are available. Obviously, Bill put together a system that wasn't affordable with the resources available.
Mm-hmm.
Not his own fault. I mean, they lost county insurance and had to go out in the market. I mean, they're trying to form a county service district to deliver transportation services, but they will choose to do that, or they're choosing to do that without a tax base.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are many problems, and we're trying to address it because the needs are profound on the South Coast, and we're trying to help as best we can.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. They really are, and I just want to emphasize again that even though it's easy to say, by the way, the little bus isn't going to run anymore, what you're saying is you may not get dialysis, you may not get your radiation. It's really a human critical issue. And any way that I can help, I would be more than happy to spend some time doing it, but I don't know exactly how to fix the problem other than money. And that's too bad, because there's not a lot of that.
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, we need the help of you and everyone to solve this problem. We have some money, but it takes more than that, and we'll be back with you on this issue.
Are we setting ourselves up for failure on this program? I'm looking here, and you know, in the inner city passenger service, we've got $947,000, and then you look at the mission, and it's, you know, the commission is calling for people living in communities of 2,500 or more to have same day round trip access to the next largest market economy. How in a million years can you achieve that on $947,000?
Chair Smith, the answer is that we can't. I won't bore you with the technical details about exactly what intercity transportation means to the federal government, but it's not a common sense definition. Technically, the service that Mr. Dooley provides and Coast Transit provides up and down 101 technically isn't intercity service, and we use every single grant resource we have in our bag of tricks to help support the Coastal Connector on the South Coast. So you're right. The 947 doesn't mean to touch it. And, in fact, I don't think any of that 947 is currently invested in that Coosa County service. But our other resources to benefit the seniors and people with disabilities are general public resources, and everything else we can think of that's legal, we try to apply as best we can.
Okay, so how do we help the commission, how do we help the department not create an expectation that we just can't deliver on? I mean, I think in my area, and I'm the opposite corner of the state, and I just feel like we're setting you folks up for failure on this issue.
Chair Smith, actually, in this area, the policy adopted by the Transportation Commission was that every community in Oregon of 2,500 or more people would have same-day round-trip access to the next largest market economy. And before Greyhound pulled out, we were 93% of communities of 2,500 or more met that goal. When Greyhound abandoned service to 35 Oregon communities, we lost ground. And the resources to make up that ground are limited and expected to continue to be limited.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Berger.
One thing that I'd like to know is there any criteria, for instance, because Bay Area Hospital, and it is a medical center for the South Coast, is there any criteria that puts it in any kind of priority for those from Myrtle Point, Powers, Coquille, on down south to Brookings?
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, yes. That's very high priority transportation that we try to address those needs.
It, really quick, and then I want to move on. Is there a partnership between special needs transportation services and inner city passenger program? Or are those two completely separate and separate for a reason?
Chair Smith, they are actually separate. I mean, the situation on the South Coast is different. Normally, when we talk about inner city passenger service, it's service delivered by a private sector agency, a private for-profit entity of one sort or another. Like on the South Coast, it would be Porter Stages or one of the other local companies. Most of the service delivered by seniors or for seniors and people with disabilities is delivered by not-for-profit corporations like the senior center that Mr. Dooley works for and hundreds of others around the state.
So just so I'm clear, intercity passenger program is to help move all people.
Yes.
Where special needs is for folks with special needs.
That's correct, Chair Smith.
To me, it just seems like there ought to be, knowing that resources are limited, there ought to be some type of connection between those two to see if we could leverage those into something greater. But let's move on.
Okay. The department has covered performance measures. I would just briefly touch on two. On page 11 is a table that charts the growth in transit ridership. From 92 to 2003, the number of rides delivered by all the public transit agencies in Oregon increased 68% from some 69 million to 116 million. That's an average of about 6% a year when population is increasing 2% a year. It's also larger than the growth in vehicle miles traveled on the highway system. The next page, page 12, includes a table that talks about the transportation for seniors and people with disabilities delivered with ODOT resources. And the table is expressed in rides per capita, but essentially the number of rides we were able to deliver with ODOT resources was in the mid 3 million a year to high 3 million a year until you increased the resources available to us in 99, and since then we've gotten up to over 6 million rides a year, and we thank you for that help. Moving on to the major budget drivers, and Senator Verger touched on one. The biggest driver for us is changing demographics. The fact that the age 65-plus population will move from about 12% of the population to some 22% of the population in the next 40 years. At the same time that our department, through its DMV unit, is making sure that drivers have the skills needed to operate vehicles, more and more people will be losing their driving privileges. And our challenge is to provide public alternatives for those who can't drive. This is a significant challenge, and in this area I can honestly quote from, I guess, my favorite Funny Pages character of my youth, Pogo, who said, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." The moving on, other issues were touched on briefly. The coordination challenge that Chair Smith referenced. There are a lot of transportation resources spent in various programmatic areas by different agencies, and it's obvious that we need to do a better job of coordinating those expenditures, and we're trying hard to do that, but sometimes doing is harder than saying, and we're working hard at that.
Yeah, and I wasn't alluding to you need to do better. I was just...
We do.
I'm just trying to figure out how to leverage to the maximum extent possible.
It just in passing, again, another major budget driver for our transit programs is fuel costs. That was touched on earlier. I won't belabor the point. Why don't we go to page 25, which summarizes the numbers in the budget. The $53 million in requested expenditure limitation is really two revenue sources. State other funds are about just under 40% of the budget, and the rest is federal funds. And the key thing I would want to point out there is that over 90% of this budget limitation, some $48 million, will pass through ODOT's budget through grants and aid to local governments.
Just ask one question.
Senator Carter.
In terms of the $947,000 for intercity, I mean, is that money that you allocate within the controls of your budget, or how is that dollar amount arrived at?
Chair Smith, Senator Carter, there's a formula program that the Federal Transit Administration runs for cities of 50,000 and fewer people and rural areas. And Oregon, based on its population, gets a certain amount of money for people living in those areas. It's, in round numbers, about $3.5 million a year. By federal law, each state receiving that kind of formula money must spend at least 15% of those resources addressing intercity passenger service needs, unless the governor signs a waiver saying those needs are met. Clearly, that's not the case in Oregon, and that 947 represents that 15%.
One other question,
please.
Say, for instance, in Heppner, in Coos Bay, does the county or some of the service provide matching funds to help pay for elderly transportation or something of that nature?
Chair Smith, Senator Carter, it practice varies widely. Mm-hmm. There are some areas where the counties have and city governments have spent local resources to provide match. Other areas that just hasn't been possible because of competing demands.
Okay, one other question.
Please.
Have you guys thought about, because more and more I hear, and I've heard of this before in terms of rural communities, have we thought about maybe, Bruce, looking at how when communities ask that maybe you could have someone give technical assistance for helping them to send off for grants in communities that need it. Because I can see with the population growing older where people are going to need more transportation to and fro for shopping and going to the doctor and going to the pharmacist and stuff of that nature. I'm wondering maybe if during the interim we can talk about that, Bruce, or we can see how we can, the department would set aside opportunity for technical assistance to our small communities to do that, because that has to be. I know as a former CEO of a nonprofit agency, those are the kind of things that communities need more than anything. And my biggest problem was I didn't have a technical assistant person to write grants, a specialist in that area. So I imagine in rural Oregon, it's even worse.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we concur, and we do, and if you want, Mr. Loring can describe some of the limited technical assistance he provides now, but clearly we'd love to have a dialogue about ways to enhance that service and help the local governments and nonprofits help themselves even more, because there are opportunities that I think that they could take advantage of, but again, because of some of the limitations that Mr. Loring has identified, it's hard for them to have the resources just to keep the systems operating.
Exactly, because it would appear to me, Bruce, that local communities like that would need, you just need somebody that does nothing but that, because I can't imagine a director who says, I look at your department, you have 24 people to be in charge of with every other things across the state. And so if there were just such a person that was doing grant writing and community affairs or whatever the name of the person would be, that person is so needed in what appears to be real strapping times for local communities of that nature.
Commissioner, Senator Carter, we do have the resources. We don't have a person writing grants for local agencies, but again, as I mentioned in the South Coast example, we're using the rural technical assistance resources we have to try to organize a consulting contract to get someone expert in the field to go down and help a local area come to grips with their opportunities and problems.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Before we move on, I have to ask one more question on the inner city. Right now, we're that $900,000. That's going to private companies to provide the service.
Chair Smith, yes.
And that's just not enough because of the rise in fuel costs and everything else. That's not enough to cover the expense that they're incurring to make this work.
Chair Smith, in some cases, the theory of our involvement is that for intercity passengers, say Greyhound, for instance, this should be a business opportunity. They should deliver service where they can get or make a profit sufficient to produce a reasonable return on capital and cover their operating costs. There are some places where where service is highly desirable from a public standpoint, where a private sector firm can't make enough money or can't make enough money fast enough, and we try to provide the minimum subsidy necessary to induce that private sector company to invest in service, particularly where it looks like they can become profitable within a reasonably small period of time.
Does it require the same-day return?
No, that's our policy.
Okay, well, I'm thinking if I'm an entrepreneur and I knew there was $900,000 there, I could figure out how to put three routes together, one that starts in Portland, heads up to Astoria, heads all the way down, come back to I-5 every day. That. Head one that goes all the way to Ontario, comes back through Burns, then back. One heads all the way down into southern Oregon, loops back up through Bend and comes back around. And I'm trying to figure out, for $900,000 a year, I bet you I could cash flow that thing out and still make some pretty decent money. What am I missing? And just have it every day as a loop.
Well, Chair Smith, actually we fund Portland to Astoria service, and we fund Coast to Ontario service.
It doesn't work.
Well, they are not making money, and we're still providing some support for the service to make sure that they can get a reasonable return.
As you work through this, and we do have to move on, from an Eastern Oregon perspective, I wouldn't expect to be able to get same day back. But if there was a way where I knew I could be part of a loop system and I paid my $40 or whatever the dollars work out to be, and I get on the bus and I head to Portland, I take care of whatever I need to, and I know I have to be back at that spot 24 hours later to hop on and head back around. I mean, to me, that's about as, for $900,000, that's about as good a service as you can expect. That's my thought.
I'd like to move to page 26 and briefly cover two policy packages. Package number 411 is a regional trip planner. The best way to describe this project is by a simile that will only be useful if some of you have used Expedia.com to book an airline ticket or a hotel room or a rental car. This is really what we're talking about trying to create through this package is it something like Expedia for public transportation, so that if you're in Newport and you want to go to Ontario, you can quickly identify in real time online what your transportation options are, get contact information, book the trip. This builds on a current phase. Most of you are familiar with ODOT's trip check site, where you go to look at the pass cameras or see how a particular stretch of freeway is doing. You know, during a current phase, we're building sort of like an electronic yellow pages on the trip check site, so you can find out who goes from Newport to Corvallis, say, and what the schedule is, but it's not real-time online. It's a static display of that information. You can get the schedule and write it down and make your own connections. This package would take that system and turn it into a real-time online service. We're doing it in conjunction with the state of Washington, so it will help people travel through public means throughout the Northwest, you know, provide resources to senior centers and whatever so they can help their clients book trips. That's that package. The second package, number 412, that I'd like to discuss is the Mass Transit Vehicle Replacement Program. This builds on the success of the $2 million that you gave us in the 2003 session. We're asking another $2 million in federal funds to increase the number of old high mileage vehicles we can replace. Again, with the $2 million you provide us in 03, we're able to replace 14 vehicles for six agencies. We've received requests for some 40 vehicles, and with another $2 million, I've gone through the requests, and we can meet close to half of that demand, some 20 vehicles with another $2 million.
What happens to the old vehicles?
In Chair Smith, a variety of circumstances. My friend Bill Dooley from the South Coast was commenting earlier that, you know, in the urban area we buy low-floor vehicles so you can roll on the curb. Roll from the curb straight on. On the South Coast, they have no floor vehicles after several hundred thousand miles because the rust has eaten away all the metal. In some cases, they get scrapped. In other cases, they're traded in, refurbished, and used by someone for an additional period of time.
Most of the vehicles we're trading out are fully depreciated out.
Chair Smith, yes. I mean, there are our policy is that we don't replace vehicles that haven't exceeded the federal standards for the type of vehicle. For a large bus, that's 12 years, 600,000 miles.
Wow.
Now, there are vehicles around that are 25 years old and have 1.5 million miles on them, and they're still in use. Chair Smith, that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any further questions you might have.
Yeah, that was very, very informative. Senator Berger.
I just want to make a couple of comments. One is that one of the things we have lots of on the coast are tourists, and you realize that the tourists visit Oregon and we get nothing at all. They use the roads, and yet we've not figured out a way that the public is willing to kind of use that. And I don't know the answer, but I know that there's a potential if we can ever find a way, because when I go someplace, I have to pay, and that money is used to help maintain the roads in other states. The other thing is there any connection between your division at all in looking at the number of vehicles that we keep in the motor pool. I was down at the motor pool recently, and I just see too many vehicles not used. I mean, you have a whole acreage of vehicles to accommodate. I know we have a large staff in the state, but I would think that those vehicles could be driven all the time. And if you didn't have so many, that they would turn over more rapidly, and that would relieve you of some of the funding maybe that you need on an emergency basis. I just think sometimes when we live in real trouble times and emergency times, you start looking at every possibility to get in revenue and some extra money. And I would encourage you to analyze that. If there could be a nexus between that and this, because that would be what I would want.
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, we will pass those remarks on to our friends at the Department of Administrative Services that manage the state motor pool and consider it in the use of ODOT's vehicles. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think DMV's up now. Barney Young, come on up. You know, okay. How much time do you think you're going to need, Lauren?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay, and then, Troy, is that going to be adequate time for you, folks? Okay. Perfect.
That's assuming, of course, Mr. Chair, you don't ask me anything.
She's good.
Very good.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division. And if you would please turn to the tab in the book that is for the Driver and Motor Vehicles Division, I'll start in. DMV is probably one of the few agencies that most Oregonians come in contact with sometime during their lives. And so we are committed to providing good quality customer service. Our mission is to promote driver safety, protect the financial ownership in interest in vehicles, and, of course, to collect revenue for the highway. As you can see, there's a wide range of statutes that we administer. We have approximately 824 positions we'll be asking for in this budget. Three positions are in a POP, and we're not going to be asking for that POP, and I'll talk about that later. About 50% of our staff are located in our field services, 64 field offices scattered out the state. About 98% of Oregonians live within 30 miles of a field office. 30% of our staff are in headquarters are involved in the processing section, which does all the back office work for the title and vehicle processing, anything that's not done in the field office, as well as handles all of our driver safety, conviction recording and suspensions, et cetera. Our customer services unit manages our two call centers, one in headquarters and one located at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, as well as handles all of our record services and records requests. And finally, program services is essentially merged together with information technology, and that's the area that develops and implements legislation, develops policy and procedures, does analysis and study, and provides all the business oversight for any of our information technology projects. Moving on to page 2, the target for all of our services is the general public, with the one exception of the business regulation program located within our vehicle section. Our driver programs include driver licensing, identification, driver safety, the disabled parking permit program, ensuring vehicles are insured, and the financial responsibility is the term, and, of course, the motor voter program, which is part of a federal mandate to help voter registration through driver licensing. Under our vehicle program section, we have registrations and trip permits, which are essentially temporary registrations, titles, and then business regulation. And business regulation is regulating vehicle dealers and drive schools, as well as wreckers and other aspects of the vehicle industry. Our service goals are to provide fast, efficient, and high-quality service, options for doing business with DMV, confidential treatment of personal information. Our services are delivered through our field offices, our mail transactions, telephone call centers, internet, and public and private partnerships. Moving on to page 3, I'll do a brief overview of our driver programs. Of course, driver licensing and identification.
Really quick, I want to Yes, sir. I'm going to go to 21 minutes now. under customer satisfaction, I shared with you before how pleased I am with the DMV and the treatment I get when I go there. Do you folks have a process where you work with the counter employees on how to greet citizens when they come in?
Mr. Chair, we have a customer service training for both our telephone agents as well as our field agents.
Yeah, my experience has been very, very positive, and so I say that right up front.
Mm-hmm.
But I also share that you truly are one of the front doors of state government. And you know, without a fiscal impact associated with it, I think it'd be terrific. And if this sounds corny, I apologize to the committee and to everyone listening, that when someone comes up to the counter, it's good morning, good afternoon, how may I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that I can do to be of assistance to you? Have a nice day. And I don't know how you could instill that, but I think you could take something that's already good
mm-hmm.
and make it great just by doing a little bit of continuous improvement.
I will take that to advice and work on that more. Thank you.
I got to tell you, I think you have a real opportunity to make the DMV shine more than it already does.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that that's corny at all.
So I think it makes people feel good. They come in there and it's like, oh, what am I doing here? That's the rash.
I think it's a good idea.
But when you're greeted at the counter with, how can I help you?
Our driver programs are involved with, of course, driver licensing and identification, something that's highly in the news these days. So we're not only looking at making sure that you have the knowledge and the experience to drive, but we're making sure that you are who you say you are and that you are an Oregon resident, and those requirements are going to get even more rigorous in the future. We license about 1.1 million driver license. We issue about 1.1 million driver license and ID cards a year, and there are about 2.8 million licensed drivers. As you will see as you go through this presentation, DMV is all about transaction volume and processes, and trying to make sure that we have quality customer service and standardized delivery of that service. We promote driver safety by not only making sure you meet the initial standards, but by retesting individuals who may need to have an initial re-exam because of driving behavior. We record all of the driver sanctions by the courts, any traffic violations, administer any court-ordered suspensions or revocations, and also have administrative authority to take what we call driver improvement suspensions or restrictions for individuals who have a series of driving transactions over a two-year period. We have in place as well the graduated driver license, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with, that has been very successful in Oregon in helping reducing teen fatality and injury. In fact, we've experienced well over almost a 40% reduction in the 4 years it's been in place. And then finally, the medically at-risk program, which has been in place for at least a year, a significant and important change to the way we manage drivers who may have mental or physical impairments. We now require mandatory reporting of all conditions, but only take action against to restrict or remove the driver license for those individuals who have a condition that is so severe that it's not controllable by medication or any kind of therapy and affects their ability to safely drive. So we see that as a significant improvement and essentially a model for the nation. Disabled placards is another program that the DMV administers, and we issue those for individuals who are qualified through physician certification. We also, as I said earlier, register voters by mail or in field offices. We also are involved in ensuring that or making sure that people have insurance for their vehicle, both at the time in which they register by requiring that they provide that information. We also do random sampling of drivers to determine whether or not they have insurance, and there has been in place for the last 3 or 4 years a automated liability insurance reporting system that allows us as well as law enforcement to know the status of insurance, which has been a boon to our sampling program as well as to law enforcement's efforts to keep people insured.
How does that work with the law enforcement?
How it works, Mr. Chair, is that all of the insurance companies are required to electronically transfer to us their book of business within 30 days of a cancellation or 15 days of a new policy. They notify us. It goes onto an interactive database that's available through the law enforcement data system. So when a police officer pulls you over for some other reason, they can also check whether you're insured and then ask for proof of insurance if it shows up a negative, because there obviously is a lag time, and so it's not 100% reliable.
Okay. Thank you.
On the vehicle program side, we register vehicles to make sure that they can be identified. That's the purpose of the license plate, and also to raise revenue for the highway. There are 4 million registered vehicles in Oregon, and we conduct about 2 million registration actions a year. That's both new and renewals. In that, we have partnership in the sense that we are working with the Department of Environmental Quality to make sure that before we register vehicles, they pass the emissions requirements. And in turn, the DEQ conducts about 25% of the renewals for us. So for renewals, registration renewals, there are at least 4 avenues for individuals: the internet, through the mail, in the field offices, and to the DEQ stations.
Really quick, let me ask this question. The Department of Motor Vehicles generates a substantial amount of money, substantially more money than they use to operate the DMV. I just want to make sure I'm correct on that. About $526 million, is that?
Mr. Chair, yes. We our ratio is about 4-1. In terms of revenue raised and expenditures that we're set up deliberately to be a revenue generating source for the highway fund.
Perfect. Thank you.
Primarily through title and registration fees.
Thank you.
As you know, in addition to we also have special plate programs that raise money for specific purposes, cultural trust funds, salmon plate, Crater Lake plate, and then group plates. And, of course, every session there are interest in adding to that list. Titles are issued primarily to provide proof of ownership as well as to protect lien holders. We inspect the VINs of vehicles coming into the state before we issue titles, and before any title is issued, we check that title against the both state and federal stolen vehicle lists and then hold up all of those transactions until that can be resolved if we find a match with a stolen vehicle. We're issuing about 1.2 million titles a year, which is, as I said before, another source of revenue for the highway fund. And then finally, we regulate vehicle businesses. We license vehicle dealers, wreckers, appraisers, transporters. And the purpose there is to make sure that titles are correctly transferred and that security interest holders get paid off and their liens are appropriately recorded. We're also regulating drive schools to make sure that they're operating safely. And in this program, we have civil penalty authority as well as license revocation authority to manage the vehicle business.
I'm jumping around on you. I apologize for that in committee. I apologize. The transfers to economic community development, transfers to Veterans Affairs, transfers to education. What are those?
Mr. Chair, those transfers out are usually from plates, the group plates, economic development, the cultural plate goes there, cultural trust fund goes to economic development, Veterans Affairs are the veterans plates.
Thank you.
We have covered the service to our performance measures, so I'm going to move on to page 8 and talk briefly about the major budget drivers. Our external and internal costs are influences primarily our increasing costs, and as you see with most all of the budgets, the cost increase are primarily driven by the rise in personnel costs. Managing multiple service delivery, we're not able to close any one channel because we're dealing with a wide range of economic and diverse population. We need to make sure that people have access to field offices. Not everyone can or use the internet, and so as we open one channel, we still need to maintain all of the others. Managing public expectations in relation to the security of the driver license and identity card, and federal mandates. Federal mandates are going to become an increasingly large component of our budget, especially since it appears that the REAL ID Act will be passed by the Senate today, and that will make some significant changes in the driver license issuance process for our regular driver license. In the past, federal mandates have primarily been felt on our commercial driver license. And then, of course, they're continuing to make improvements in our information system. Our customer base is growing. It's aging. It's becoming more diverse.
Representative Avakian.
You mentioned federal mandates. I assume you've also been following potential legislation within this building that would affect, I assume, some systems with respect to IDs, the driver's license you offer, the IDs that you need to require in order to get a driver's license.
Mr. Chair, Representative Alkin, we have been very closely involved with all of the proposed changes to the driver license issuance process.
And without launching you into something that would take a much longer discussion, are you planning for any potential costs that might be incurred because of that potential state legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, we have prepared fiscal impact statements for each of the proposed bills, and our expectation would be if each of those bills will come down to Ways and Means for your consideration.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip over the major budgetary issues section because those are primarily related to the packages, and I will discuss those there. The major changes in the past 10 years, I'll let you read that section at your leisure in case, unless there's something you particularly want to discuss there. I've included just a brief explanation of our major initiatives. Each biennium we develop a service delivery plan that talks about what we're going to do to improve our mission in each of our major areas of responsibility, and once again I'll let you review that at your leisure. Moving on to page 12, our interagency intergovernmental programs are pretty much the same as they were last time. We have long-standing partnerships that help deliver our services. The new item on the list is electronic vehicle registration partnership with the vehicle industry. Currently, car dealers do collect title and registration applications as well as fees, but now through a new program, approximately 100 of them are also signed up to provide license plates and stickers at point of sale.
Let me ask you a question back on continuous improvement.
Yes.
How are folks able to own a problem? I come in to the DMV and I come in with an issue that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. How do I get handled?
Mr. Chair, we would take a look at your problem, determine what we're able to do under rule statute authority. We'd try and figure out if there's some way we can solve it. I end up with a number of those at my desk. They are handled every day at all levels of DMV. And essentially we are looking for a solution that still fits within the statute.
What I'm trying to get at is the person behind the counter who, when I come up to the counter and I show up with a wrinkled check, I mean, I'm making something up. Does the person behind the counter have the ability to own the issue and to work through the issue, or do they get passed to somebody?
Mr. Chair, it's really going to depend upon the level of the problem. If they can resolve it there at the counter, they have the responsibility to do so. They may need the consultation of their lead worker or their manager. If it's something that requires assistance from headquarters, they call into the call center for more direction. Many times what we'll do is if the customer's got a particularly good onerous problem, they'll work directly with the headquarters expertise to resolve it. But our goal is to try and resolve customer problems, to solve them.
Thank you. I'm going to hit this one more time and mm-hmm. move on. I just think this is so important, knowing that you are a face of state government, that you know everything you can do to make this the most pleasant experience, from the tone of voice to the ownership of a problem to have a nice day at the end, really needs to be done. Because in the end, you know, whether the governor looks good or not is based upon how that person behind the counter treats that person. Whether people won't grumble as much about paying their taxes or not is based upon that person behind that counter. Whether people will support our school levies is based upon that person behind that counter. And I think that's a tremendous responsibility that you have on your shoulders. And I hope, you know, anything we can do to help you with that, mm-hmm. we want to.
I appreciate your comments about having them do everything they can to make our governor look good.
Well, I think that's true, though. And, you know, and I, again, I apologize. I'm a business consultant, but I believe in continuous improvement. I think you folks do well, but I think every chance there is to say, have a nice day. Welcome to the Department of Motor Vehicles. May I help you? I think that ought to be done.
Mr. Chair, we take our responsibility as a face of state government very seriously, and we are also committed to continuous improvement.
Terrific. Thank you.
Moving on to process changes, there's a long list there, but I just wanted to highlight a couple. As I've said earlier, we've opened up a new Internet channel for registration renewals and address changes. We've made we've implemented an electronic connection between ourselves and law enforcement to provide photos more quickly and less expensively to them. We've moved all of the calls now from the DMV field offices to our call centers so that, there's nothing more irritating than to be standing at the desk waiting on somebody and then have a phone interrupt you. So all of the calls in the field office have now been moved to our call center. We've installed ATMs in majority of our field offices to allow customers to have cash because at this point we're not taking debit or credit cards. And we've augmented our ID verification and issuance process with tighter standards starting in 2004. We have a rather small professional services budget, about $8.8 million, and the bulk of that is now on page 14 under the uses of professional services. The bulk of that $8.8 million is spent on our contract with the hearings division of Employment Department, the hearings officer panel that handles all of our applied consent hearings and our Administrative Procedures Act hearings, as well as our expenditures for Coffee Creek. And then you can see there the remaining $1.2 million is just your standard list of goods and services that we would need to get our work done. We have quite a few bills that are moving through the session. Most of them seem to be moving fairly well. Some of you may be on committees where you've seen them. I know Senator Verger certainly has. I don't anticipate too many problems with getting most of those through. So that moves us down to page 19, which is our budget. As you can see, our request of $131 million is actually going to be reduced by $1 million. We are not going to be asking for package 203. That package was approximately $1 million and 3 FTE, and that package was to enable us to provide fingerprint services to implement the hazardous materials background check component of the USA Patriot Act. Fortunately, the Homeland Security Department has contracted with a private firm that will provide that service in about 50% of the states, and so we have chosen to go with that. So I just wanted to let you know that the budget that we are requesting is a little smaller than what you see on page 19. And if you take a look at the expenditure by category, you see that the primary increase in the budget is in personal services. About $6 million of that increase in personal services goes to pay for PERS and pension bond funding, and the remainder, of course, would be for increase in salaries. The only other thing that you might be curious about is that special payment line. That's increased from $68,000 to $1.2 million. $800,000 of that was part of that package that would have been payments for background checks, which will be excised out of the budget, and the remainder is for our intergovernmental agreements with the Health Division and the DEQ. Moving on then to our package requests, which start on page 20, We are asking for additional funding for essentially to make sure that we maintain our customer service levels of about $1.1 million for temporary services. Our temporary services budget has been reduced systematically over the last three biennia to a high of $1.6 million down to about $100,000, which is inadequate for us to be able to cover with changes in workload that we essentially supplement our base staff with temporary services to meet, to fill in behind the people on vacation, to fill in behind the individuals who are on long-term leave, and also to deal with the changes in workload that occur sporadically over the year. So we see that this is a critical package for us to make sure that we maintain our service delivery goals year-round. Package 202 we're withdrawing as well. It was to help us deal with a temporary surge in workload to fulfill federal mandates, and if we are able to gain approval for Package 201, we'll absorb that work with Package 2 and Package 202. So we'll take that off the table. Package 203, as I said before, we're taking off the table because there's now a private vendor that will provide those services. Package 204 is a request for additional increase in merchant fees. Our projections for how much it would cost us for merchant fees for our internet our base funding will not cover what we consider to be our projected expansion for that service level, as well as the fact that at the time in which we did the calculation, that was prior to the increase in the registration fee. So we are asking for an augmentation of $230,000 there. And at the bottom of page 21, you'll see there's a note that we're also asking for a additional adjustment, an additional request of $340,000, because the DEQ now wants to move towards using debit credit cards at their emission stations, and since they are collecting approximately 25% of our registration renewals, obviously you're going to be having both paid at the same time by credit card, and our share of the merchant fees for those transactions would be an additional $340,000.
Are renewals the only fees that can be transacted online right now?
That require money, yes. Otherwise, the only other transaction online is, there's two. You can send us a notice of sale of car as well as send us a notice of an address change. But as far as commerce, the registration renewal is the only one that's online. Package 205 is an additional request because of the increased cost of our new photo license. At $1.50, we've gotten a good deal. Most other states are paying at least $2 a license for the enhanced license that we've got. But still, it is a 28% increase over what our current or our past cost per photo issuance was, and so we're asking for an additional $500,000 for that. And then the final package is the standard smart buy reduction, and that is the end of my presentation.
Well, you are good. Right on schedule. Any questions? Any comments? Senator Berger.
I don't have a question. I guess that I just wonder if we continue to try to do too many things through your department. It seems like constantly increase. Either we're trying to do, let's take just the driver's license itself. We continue to try to use it. I just wonder if you went back to the card that says you can drive a car or a truck, and I get a card, and that's it. I mean, that's what it all started out as, just a license to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got all of this that we use the license for. Would you like to make any comments on that at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I think there'd be 51 jurisdictions that would be pleased if we could just go back to a driver license. But the problem would be you would have some other agency in front of you that would be issuing the government-issued identification. So whether you put that responsibility at the DMV or you put that responsibility someplace else, there will be some place where you need to have government-issued ID these days. And so that's essentially why it has moved to the DMV, because we are already in the business, as it were, of establishing who you are for driving purposes, and so it escalated into a lot more social purposes besides just driving.
Mr. Chair, but we have a system that if you want to beat the system, you can beat it after all the expense that we've gone to. For instance, I go and I buy a car off of a lot, and I want the title. And they give me the title, and it was Joe Smith's car. And I don't transfer that title to my name because I don't want that title in my name. I get in a wreck, and Joe Smith is the owner of that vehicle. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we can in-run you. So, I don't know. That's probably a conversation for another day. But when I look at how much money we spend, when we just are desperate for some basic services in Oregon, it does disturb me.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Joanne was talking about buying a car. I was wondering if you could recommend a good dealership.
Where do you think I should go?
Well, Ms. Young, thank you very much.
I'm sorry,
Representative Vauquin.
I just wanted to make sure I was understanding what you were saying. Are you saying you think that DMV was the appropriate place to have some type of a broader identification card, or just by happenstance it landed there, whether it was appropriate or not?
Mr. Chair, only having been at Representative Vauquin, only having been here for 5 years, I don't know all of the history why DMVs across the nation became the identification agencies, but they have. DMVs issue identification cards in addition to driver licenses, and driver licenses have over time become identification cards. I can give you a Ron Blankenbaker editorial from the 1970s in which he was complaining about the driver license becoming an ID card.
No, it's been a long history. I know it's ended up there. I'm just curious on what your opinion is as to whether or not you think that that is the appropriate place for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vauquin, given that we are already set up to do it, it would be, you could excise it out of the DMV and put it someplace else, but would that be economic is the question. We already have processes in place and are expected to, for our own purposes, to assure your identity. And so I can understand why there is the convergence for other purposes.
Is that good?
No.
Would you be willing to?
I understand the comment, but I think it's an. I understand your response. I just think it's an important issue, and we're considering it in all kinds of new ways now. And you are the director. I mean, you are the expert for us to look to on the proper functioning of your department. And I don't know that I got an answer as to whether or not. And if you don't want to give it, that's okay. That's your choice. But I don't know that I got an answer whether or not you think it's the appropriate place. I hear very clearly from you that it is the place, but those are two different questions.
What I'm going to ask in the interest of time on this is if you could swing by and just have a brief conversation with Representative Vauquin.
Not necessary.
Well, I think this is an issue both the House and the Senate are going to be dealing with in the coming days, and I think it would be good to have a level of comfort. And at some point, I would appreciate some further discussion on this in terms of legislation that is coming through this building in terms of identification issues. So, but why don't we move on now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the good work you're doing at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Troy, you're up. 18 minutes. Will that work for you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you want to have anyone else come up with you, or you're good? Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your recognition and welcome of the three members from the governor-appointed Traffic Safety Committee. They just happened to be meeting today, and so it worked well for them to be here earlier this afternoon. I refer you to the pages behind the tab, the Transportation Safety Division, and start out on page one. have to let you know that the safety office was created in 1967 and 1969 in the state of Oregon as a reaction to Congress creating the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and requiring all states to have a state-level agency dealing with highway safety. That when that was created, the Highway Safety Office became the focal point from the national perspective of where highway safety grants and programs would be funneled and channeled and provided. The legislation also created the 5-member Traffic Safety Committee and gave them responsibility for coordinating, planning, and conducting a statewide highway safety program. In 1991, the legislature moved the then independent Highway Safety Office into ODOT, and where we sit today as a fully functioning division reporting to the director of the department. Our program is extremely oriented towards citizen involvement, as Chair Mark Koberstein from the Traffic Safety Committee mentioned. And when you turn to page 2, that's indicative of the fact that our target group is everybody in the state that uses the roads and streets, not just motor vehicles, but also bicyclists, skateboarders, walkers, and anybody on the system. Our program is basically created into two parts: statewide operations, which includes all the staff, but also the assistance that we provide through videos, through brochures, through training, through video library and research and assistance of local groups, which for me, my goal now going into my 8th year as the manager is that I do not want to see that portion of the program exceed 20%. The other side of the program is the field program, which is a goal to at least match 80% of our budget, and that is where we're providing direct service, grants, and activities around the state. And some of those examples are an intensive program with Multnomah County Courthouse to deal with the high-end repeat offenders that for driving under the influence of intoxicants and to deal with them separately because of their issues with substance abuse. And some of the other safe community projects that are listed there on page 2. We do our program on an annual basis, and we create an annual traffic safety performance plan. This document includes all of the monies, federal and state, that we deal with and by topic, and that is how we identify where we're going to work on projects, what the project's going to do. And as Mr. Koberstein mentioned in that federal letter, this document and this plan on how we conduct our business is held up as a national model. Also, at the end of every year, when we deal with our field programs, we do an annual evaluation. And so we start out with what are we planning to do, and then we publish a document that lists out exactly what we spent our money on, what projects around the state, and what that money did in terms of highway safety and what it purchased. That is work coordinated under the service delivery summary on page 2, where we deal with multitudes, hundreds of individuals through either governor-appointed committees or division manager-appointed committees, or in some cases our program levels have very specific citizen committees that help them do their work. In relationship to performance measures on page 3 for highway safety, Oregon is recognized as a national leader in doing problem identification and choosing how we use our funds. And the reason is right there for you on page 3 relating to fatalities and injuries. This last 5 years, the lowest number of traffic fatalities on our roads and streets in this state since Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House.
Senator Johnson.
Considering that you're referring to Mr. Eisenhower in the White House, and I'm reflecting back that he was there when I was, we don't need to go any of those places in terms of age.
Who are you talking about?
I'm teasing.
That's right, you were.
And
he was a Republican president.
Tell me how you correlate how well we're doing now in terms of fatalities and the fact that we have absolutely decimated the number of officers that are out patrolling our highways.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, it's because Oregon, one, has a program that's citizen-based, and number two, we've been very careful to make sure that we apply what we call the 4 E's of highway safety. And the 4 E's are enforcement, engineering, education, and emergency medical services. And when one of those 4 is not doing so well, the other 3, one way or another, try and step up and try and help. And you are right, Senator, not having law enforcement, it's not just state police, but it's a lot of local law enforcement, don't have traffic teams anymore. Yeah. And a lot of the grants further into the safety division budget, you'll see we do a tremendous amount of work with law enforcement, and we fund overtime for law enforcement around the state so that there is somebody there doing traffic. But part is the fact that we've done some of those efforts in those other areas to surround the fact that we are weak. Of the four pieces, we are the weakest in law enforcement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Avakian.
Any possibility that this is also reflects just better standards in car manufacturing and airbags and seatbelts and things like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Avakian, that is part of the E of engineering. Engineering is both for the vehicle side of things as well as the roadway side of things.
Okay.
And, yes, the fleet age in this state has gotten better, which means you have better cars that are new, but also in the used car market there are better cars in relationship to airbags, side bars in relationship to crashes coming from that area as well.
Mr. Chair?
Senator West.
I think to fully vet this subject, I guess the question I would ask is how are our rates of fatalities and serious injury accidents compared to other 11 Western states? I mean, are we declining at about the same rate? Are we doing better? Are we not quite as good because of the enforcement part? I mean, give me a yardstick here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westland, Oregon, if compared nationally first, and then I'll do some local state comparisons as well. Nationally, for the last 5 years, Oregon has been, from a fatality point of view, based on the vehicles in our state, and an injury point of view, based on vehicles in our state, the last 5 years we've been better than the national average. We were worse than the national average for the previous 50 years. So we've gone from worse than to better than really quick. How do we compare it with other states? In relationship to California, California has a better fatality rate based on vehicles on the road and injury rate, predominantly because of their vehicles on the road. Compared to the state of Washington, we are equal to, in some cases, better than the state of Washington, and that's just been recent because we were usually trailing the state of Washington. We are better than the state of Idaho, in part because of the rural nature. We are better than the state of Alaska as well as Montana. Generally, look across the United States, if you were to look at a map and what states are performing right now with the funds they have and making a difference in the lives in their state from a highway safety point of view, the West Coast lights up as being very good programs, including the state of Hawaii, and some of the northeastern states light up as well as being those that are leading the pack nationally and doing better than the national average. We're very, very fortunate in the state to have so much support and basically a citizenry that gets it. We voted in a safety belt law in the state as citizens. It was not mandated through the legislature. We're the only state in the nation that has that. Ourselves looked at how we want to make sure that for our own personal well-being of something we voted in 1990. So we have a citizen that gets it and, generally speaking, obeys by the rules of the road and the laws, and that's part of the E for the education piece is that people know what they're supposed to do.
Thank you. That's a very comprehensive answer.
Senator Carter.
There are some of us who bear scars and seek that laws.
Let's continue.
Speaking of seatbelts, on page 4, in relationship to watching where we are in Oregon in relationship to safety belt use, we are at 94% use by an observational survey that is one of the two contracts we actually do out of the safety division. We have a firm that does research for us. One of those is observed use of seatbelts. At 94%, we are in the top 4 in the United States. The national average is 80%.
What do we need to do to be number one?
Mr. Chair, that was one of the questions you asked in phase one. a couple different things. A lot of people, when law enforcement makes that contact with them because they're not in their seat or the child is not in the approved seat, is generally because they forgot. And so one of the things we need to keep doing is have the messages out there through public service announcements or through some of the signs on the side of the road that you may have seen, just to act as a reminder. Because there are those, that's the number one issue, people say that. There are also those that feel it's their freedom of choice or their personal freedom that they don't have to do it, and fine, give me the ticket. And there are a percentage of folks that are in that category, and that's where law enforcement comes in as far as that's where a citation occurs versus a conversation.
Is that a rural perspective more than an urban, or is it statewide?
Mr. Chair, there are pockets, and it tends to be rural. They're a little lower, but in those cases, those are 85, 88% safety belt use rate areas of the state. That's better than the national average. That's better than some states that are sitting at 61% as a whole state. So our low areas are still in the top tier when you compare it across the U.S.
So what do we need to do to get to number one?
Mr. Chair, I think we need to continue the education piece. I think we need to make sure that in relationship to child seats and booster seats, which is laws passed by this body and booster seats most recently, that we have those available, particularly for those that can't afford it, either free or with a small charge. I think we need to make sure that law enforcement is present, and so our grants to law enforcement make them be available. The car industry is likely going back to some of those the messages in your dashboard about not wearing seatbelts. There's innovative ways for that to come about, so that the car industry is going to help us out as well from a reminder point of view, because they want you as a return customer as well, and so I'd like to see you in your seatbelts. In our case, a lot of it is maintenance of effort and weaving all together all those different pieces that have an impact on this area as well as a couple of the others that the safety division is working on.
Thank you.
Highlight for you in the alcohol-related fatality area, just that Oregon, for the last couple of years, has finally been below the national average in that area as well. That doesn't mean that we can smile and say and wash our hands and say we're done with drinking driving, because one of the things in the state that's starting to become more and more prevalent is drugged driving. Drug-involved driving now is 10 to 11% of our fatality count in this state, above and beyond what it is in relationship to alcohol. Every year we go through the evaluation of these measures and moving them forward, compare ourselves against national and compare ourselves against regional. And the region that we work in is Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And so we do some cooperative work as well with the states, particularly the state of Washington, on some of the initiatives that we have in highway safety.
Senator Carter.
Are we doing any better with our teens in our schools and with so much teenage death? I mean, I worry about that so much. And I know we're down some, but we've still, especially when you look at outlying areas, because the kids have more freedom, they tend to drive faster and that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carter. We have made a tremendous reduction in the teen involvement in crashes, as Lorna Young's indicated during her presentation. In the past 5 years, 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone's killed or injured in a traffic crash has dropped 38%. A lot of that is in part due to the teen graduated driver licensing law that was passed in 1999 and became effective in 2000. And a lot of it also is attributed to the fact that in the driver education area, there are now standards for the programs that are delivered in the state, which is not mandatory. Driver education is an option around the state, and approximately 25 to 30% of our 15-year-olds are actually taking driver education. When a study was done by a national firm on Oregon's why we dropped 38%, should have only dropped 12% compared to what other states have experienced, we did much better. One of the things they pointed out is that the kids that are taking 50 hours of driving practice plus a driver education course, as compared to 100 hours with their parent, kids taking driver education are 50% fewer citations on their record, suspensions on their record, and 15% fewer crashes. So we're promoting the driver education, driver training. The hard part is not all of the community colleges or educational service districts or high schools are offering it. We're working with private companies. You know, they fill a large need or are often the contractor to the public body to do driver training. But because it's optional, the only way to get it in is if parents go to their school board and ask for it to be brought back in, or they petition their community college or something to bring it back in. Otherwise, it's really up to the public school people whether or not they're going to offer it.
Senator Berger.
Yes, Troy, are you familiar with this high-risk test that they're giving teenagers now? It shows an intersection, and it's like a video game, and you push the button when you think you ought to start slowing down for the intersection, and some of them, the riskier they are, the closer they get, and then it shows you if you crash. It's a research test. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's quite new.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, there are quite a few new movements towards what are called simulation experiences, driver simulators and things like that, that are allowed to be part of the formal driver education program.
Uh-huh.
And there are a lot of things that some of the individual companies or anybody, let alone just teens, can do online to assess their driving skill and their perception of risk. Very often in teens, they are very tunnel-focused. you and I as drivers, we've learned to look around and look down the side street or around parked vehicles or big vehicles on the side to perceive risk in a farther view. Teens are very tunnel. And so part of the issue of driver training is to get them to open up and start to recognize risk in other places. And a lot of times computers can give us that opportunity to gauge their response, to time their response, to see what they're looking at more so than we ever have in the past.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
The tape that I saw was three drivers, and one of the three was in the high-risk area. And then the instructor was educating him about the fact that he had this problem with wanting to go too close to the edge and that he would very likely not live if he continued. He was just that high a risk.
Well, colleagues, it's almost 3 p.m. What I'm going to do is ask Troy if you could come back.
Yes, sir.
And wrap up your budget with starting, I guess, with the major budget drivers on page 5. And then we'll move into Kelly. We'll have you do the rail program tomorrow. And then my understanding is, let's see. Okay, so we're going to do, then we'll move into central services. Then we're going to move into transportation program development, highway division, and transportation building updates. I think that will provide us with a full day. Once again, I want to thank the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee for being here today. We truly appreciate the work you're doing. Troy, we truly appreciate the great job you're doing. I think so often you don't hear thank you and good job, but, boy, when you look at these performance measures, it's obvious great strides have been made under your leadership, and we appreciate that. And we're hoping in 2 years you'll be able to come back to us and tell us that we're number one in safety belt use. So thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow. And seeing no other comments, questions, we are going to adjourn for the afternoon.